Welcome to Bounce Back. My name's Yvonne Fletcher from NY Events and you're listening into DRN1. Bounce Back is a fun talkback show. We get to have a chat with some comical people. Today I have Miss Samia. Hello.
Hello. How are you, Yvonne?
Very good. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, I've got lots of questions for you today.
Ooh, I'm feeling a bit nervous. This is my first radio interview, so.
Oh, I feel very privileged that you're here with me first.
So do I.
Thank you for joining me. How's your day been so far?
Good, good. I'm just on school holidays now, so I'm finally relaxing mentally and physically, so sleeping in a lot, so I'm feeling fresh today.
So you're not only a comedian, you're a teacher.
A school teacher, yeah, primary school teacher. So I teach year three, the 8-year-old kids. So.
Yeah. My youngest is in year four, so.
Yes. Yeah. So just the year before that, so you know.
Yeah.
24 of them can be a handful, so.
I can't handle my three sometimes. I don't know how you handle 24.
I think it's different because in a classroom you have like so much routine.
Yeah.
And you have like a timetable and, you know, it's different because you have – it's different to being a mother.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But nonetheless, it's very exhausting. Like teachers just look like they're about to have a mental breakdown before the school holidays. Like we really need it. We really need our school holidays.
Your recharge time, yeah. You can't keep teaching if your glass is half empty.
So. No, no. Well, actually, I've read somewhere that like the average adult makes – 40,000 decisions a day.
Wow.
So that's in your mind. So you're just everything, like should I wake up? Should I go now? Like I'm talking every single decision. And a teacher makes 60,000 a day and we suffer what's called a decision-making fatigue.
Oh, wow.
By the end of it. So that's where we burn out a lot.
Yeah.
So we deserve our holidays, okay, for any haters out there.
Oh, yeah. No. I think that has all been turned around since COVID. And then when us parents got a taste of being teacher, I never want to do that again.
The amount of friends that message me and were just like, I don't know how you do it, Sams. I don't know how you do it. Never going to complain about teachers getting holidays again.
Oh, like, no.
Yeah, I've got to agree with you on that one.
It is full on. How do you then, if you get that mental fatigue, how do you then go into comedy? Like you do some shows during the night.
I do. Yeah. I do. I think for me, Fringe 2021, this was my first ever Fringe.
Mm-hmm.
That was my big taste of what it was like to hustle, like, because I was working during the day as, you know, back to school, and it was the first few weeks of school, which is always the most stressful because you're trying to get to know your class and get everything organized. And at night time, every single night, I was performing. And that was my first taste of just running on pure adrenaline for like 1 month. I don't know how you do it, but I think when you just have to do it, you just do it.
Yeah.
And I think when you love what you do, there's that intrinsic motivation to do it.
Yeah, true.
You know what I mean? Mm. But nonetheless, I think I've had like a delayed exhaustion. And it's only recently that I really kind of crashed and burned a little bit. So you have to listen to your body. And I don't think it's a long-term sustainable thing if you don't have breaks. And if you don't have breaks for self-care as well.
Oh, that's so important. Yeah.
Very important. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we do need to have that recharge moment, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
What brought you to comedy?
What brought me to comedy? I think okay, so ever since I was younger, you know, starting from when I was 6 years old, I remember my mum telling me a story that I can't remember this, but she very clearly remembers this, that when I was six, I was waiting for my mum after school and I saw her and I got really excited and I ran towards her. But instead of running to her arms and her giving me a hug, I ran and fell straight into a bin. Like literally, and my legs, I don't know. And like my legs were like sticking up and my mum was like, how did you, you know, it started from when I was really young. Like I am just that typical person that just has a lot of like comical things in my life that happened. And over the course of, as I was growing up, I was always like the class clown. I was always the storyteller. I've had like too many to name tragic dating experiences and somehow I've always been able to turn my pain into like humor and it's been really therapeutic for me. And I remember like, you know, my friends would always be like, you know, you really should do comedy. Like, you know, the stuff that happens to you, it happens to no one. Like, one day this is going to make like a book, or one day. And it just kind of happened and happened. You know, it was always in the back of my mind. But then 3 years ago, my mum actually got diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Mm. And she was in a very critical condition, and it was a very difficult couple of years. And I think for me, that was my first massive wake-up call for me realizing how finite time was.
Yeah.
And it was all those things where I always said, oh, one day I'm going to try stand-up comedy. One day I'm going to go and, you know, do this in my bucket list. And like, it was the day my mum got diagnosed, I don't know what, this is crazy, but then I signed up for like my first stand-up gig, which was actually Raw. Couldn't have been the most like couldn't have been the, you know, the most like prestigious thing to do, and I just wanted to do it just for the sake of it.
Yeah.
So I did my first ever set, and then I just took a break for 2 years because I had to deal with my mum's cancer. But it was actually the, no, I have to do it, because I realized I really didn't have that much, you know. It was almost like every day I was waking up and staring mortality back in my face, because I was seeing it happen with my mum, who was like the most important thing in my life. And that's when I realized that I just never want to be one of those people that's just fearful of anything in my life, because I know that we don't have that much time. But I never followed it through properly until last year. So I had to sort of, that was the reason why I actually went up and did it. But then after that, took a break, and then I swore to myself that when I do go back into it, I'll do it properly and I'll be willing to put in the work. And I just wasn't in a position to commit for a couple of years. So I started 3 years ago, but I've only effectively been doing it for one.
Yeah. How is your mum now?
She's good. She's good. She went through obviously chemo for 8 months and radiation, which was just, honestly, chemo is just, it's the one of the worst things you could ever see happen to someone you love. It's like the surest way to die. But lucky for us, it was successful, and she went into remission, and she's been in remission ever since. So she's 2 years cancer-free now.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, but it is always a reminder, I think, for me. Yeah.
Samia, ovarian cancer is very hard to diagnose. How did your mum find out she had it then?
Absolutely. And off the back of that, I raised a lot of awareness, I think, just even among peers, because it was just one of those silent killers.
Yeah, it is.
Ovarian cancer often doesn't have like any symptoms at all, apart from like bloating.
Yeah.
Which isn't really, you know, so numerous times my mum was in a lot of pain, and she, I think, went to the doctors about 3 times, and they turned her away with, oh, it's probably IBS, or it's probably acidity. But then she actually went unconscious from pain one of the nights at home, and then they had to do a scan, and like that's when they came out with her. And we were just very lucky that she was in stage 2. There are 4 stages of ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
And if it had been one more stage up, even just a month longer, where it was undiagnosed, then she would have cut her chances of survival by like over 50%. So we were very, very lucky.
My goodness. And with what sort of scan did she have to get as well? Do you remember?
It was just a full body scan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It was just a full body scan. But I mean, you know, off the back of that, you know, obviously I don't want to make this a medical
interview,
but my grandmother died from ovarian cancer. My aunties have ovarian cancer. My mum obviously had it, but is in remission now. So I didn't know that it's like there's a gene testing that women can do. So if you do have ovarian or breast cancer that's quite prevalent in your family, then you can ask for what's called a BRCA gene testing for women. And what they do is they test you, and then they were able to tell you if you have an 85% chance of developing breast or ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
And that's something, because that could be in your genes. So again, you know, if you don't go in with information and knowledge, and you almost, like, I was very demanding with my GP, because I did so much research, and that's often how I deal with any sort of trauma, you know. Like my first mindset was, how am I going to help my mom? How are we going to get out of this? What do I need to know? What do I need to learn? but your doctors are not going to tell you anything. So I actually had to go and find that out. So, you know, I went and made sure that, you know, we got our testing done with my sister and I. And that's something I think really important for women to know, because we need to really, no one's going to help you but yourself, you know?
Yeah.
It's just a system after all. Like the medical, you are a number in the game. Like if you don't have knowledge for your own body, then no one else is really going to help you. So,
I met an incredible woman a couple of years ago. I went to one of her fundraisers. Her name's Kelly. She has ovarian cancer. And it came back for her. So we were all at her house. It's the first time I ever met this woman. Her energy was beautiful. But I didn't – she did an amazing video about ovarian cancer and educated us, because it isn't, like you said, a silent killer.
Yeah.
There isn't a lot of great research out there for it either. You bringing it up, sorry. I just thought we could, you know, talk about a little bit more to raise a bit of awareness, because it is an important thing too for women to know about, and hopefully with that awareness we can help save someone. So
absolutely there's not a lot of funding for ovarian cancer either. But every year there's over like 1500 women in Australia that just gets diagnosed, and it's often at the very later stages. So if you, for any listeners out there, if you are feeling bloated, you know, or experiencing any kind of like acute stomach pain, then you definitely need to just be aware of it.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for sharing. Okay. I know we deviated a little bit there.
We have.
That's okay. Who's someone that inspires you in comedy? Like, it could be anyone in the whole world.
Oh, inspires me in comedy in the whole world. Look, I'm going to probably say my first love for comedy really stemmed from and started with Russell Peters.
Yeah.
I mean, just, you know, to be like, I think he would be probably one of the first brown ethnic comedians that really made his like landmark into like the industry as like a heavyweight on a global scale.
Yeah.
And you know, just the way he has taken the mickey out of his ethnic parents' experiences, and just the way he dramatizes, you know, he was a massive inspiration for me. And he was probably one of the comedians that really just kind of sparked that love for comedy. Like, I could have watched him for hours and hours. And I think he was actually not, I think, I know he was one of the first ever comedy shows I ever went to. I went to watch him in Melbourne in like 2006, 2007. That was when he kind of was just sort of becoming a very big deal, and he was traveling like internationally. And I remember just being like mesmerized by just, you know, the whole 1 or 2 hours that he was on stage. I was just hypnotized. And he still is one of my favorite comedians.
Yeah, that's great to have a 1 to 2 hour show as well, isn't it? That's incredible.
I know. It's only now that I realize that, you know, how it's now that I do comedy. I think I was telling my friend the other day, I was like, wow, I just have this incredible level and amount of respect and admiration for people that started from nowhere, and they're just like the heavyweights in the game. You know, like you read stories like Ellen sleeping in her car and going around, you know, traveling around America. Like, you know, you read these stories about Tiffany Haddish being homeless until Kevin Hart gave her a chance, you know, and just took a chance on her. And you just think, imagine committing and dedicating your life in believing in yourself so much, even though you're going against all odds, in knowing that you're going to make it, that you would be willing to give up everything.
And that's huge, isn't it?
It's huge. Yeah. It's huge. Like, you know, I think we only see the other end of, you know, fame and success, but there's so much work and there's so much hustle that goes behind it, and there's so much risk, and there's so much you know, passion and purpose that's driven by it, that I think it's only now. Because, I mean, I'm only in small snippets, but, you know, I'm really lucky that I I'm going to say I'm lucky and I'm not, because I often say I'm really lucky that I do have a full-time stable job.
Yeah.
But then I also think on the flip side that imagine if I didn't I hope my boss isn't listening to this because I'm like, I still have my job. No, but I just mean like, imagine if I didn't, but I had all that time to dedicate into writing new content and just really kind of hustling and trying to work every room and trying to go interstate and then eventually overseas. Like these people that have really made it, they just dedicated their entire life to it. And there was never an option of failing.
Yeah.
And then now we're seeing all the glitz and glamour side of it. But it's really not that easy, isn't it?
No. And time is a problem for everyone, really.
It is.
But there might be a flip over point, and it doesn't mean that you don't want your job now. There might be a time where you go, okay, I am going to dedicate my all into this career path.
Yeah.
And go for it.
Absolutely.
But that's going to take some time to get to that point as well. I don't think you just go right at the beginning.
Yeah.
I'm dropping everything else.
You can't.
No.
You can't. And I have to marry a sugar daddy. You know what I mean? I just got to find my man who's going to support me regardless. And then I'm going to go, baby, I'm going to go and do my comedy now while you pay for our mortgage. In an ideal world.
So any sugar daddies out there? Any- Right into Samia. Don't bomb her inbox, please.
Absolutely. But, I mean, you know, Seinfeld as well said that he worked for 10 years before he felt he, you know, succeeded in his first proper stand-up set.
Yeah.
So, you know, you do – I have read a lot and sort of submerged myself in, like, the stories of many comedians to try to find like my inspiration. And I think sometimes I'm really hard on myself.
Yeah.
I definitely am probably my worst critic, as probably most of us are.
I think most, yeah.
You know, but even in like just the journey of over 1 year that I've done it, I've done comedy in the Perth scene, I've never almost been proud or happy with my progress, because I'm always thinking, how could I do better, or why can't I do this, or what is the next step, or what should I have done? And sometimes that's a little bit detrimental because you're never really appreciating the moment, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know where you find the balance, because on the flip side of it, it's good because you're always pushing yourself to improve, but on the other side of it, you're just like, are you really even enjoying the journey? So.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about mentors. I know you've got a mentor and you are now a mentor as well. Can you share a little bit about
Oh, my that? Goodness. How did I become a mentor? That was – I don't know why, but, yeah, no, I – probably the person in, like, the industry, especially in the Perth scene for me, Joe White was
– He's awesome.
He's incredible.
Yeah.
He was my first and, you know – only mentor in like the industry in a real way. And I remember meeting Joe a year ago, and we were doing the set at Lazy Susan's, and I met him, and I was following his sort of social media journey prior to meeting him, and I was a little bit mesmerized by him. But I met him and Elsa, his twin sister.
Yeah, she's beautiful.
She's stunning, you know. And immediately we had a soul connection. Like, you know when you meet people and they're just genuinely so kind?
They are.
And they illuminate just goodness, which is something just so rare that you find in people. And I remember Joe telling me, like, months later, he goes, Elsa and I met you, and we're usually, like, pretty not standoffish, but we're pretty suspicious with people that we meet off the back of, like, the first time.
Yeah.
And we were in the car and we were driving home, and Elsa was like, I just love that girl, Samia. And Joe's like, all right, calm down, you know. And Elsa was like, you know, we just need to adopt her in our family. And, like, Joe's like, all right, we need to. But then he goes, you know, it was very real for both of us. Like, we immediately felt a connection.
Yeah.
And there was just this really genuine, beautiful friendship that stemmed from day one. And I don't think it never planned to become this like mentorship or anything like that, because very soon after, Joe ended up moving to Melbourne anyway.
Yeah.
Where he was there for several months, I think up to 8 months during COVID. So, you know, there was never really any, I guess, formal conversations about comedy, but we developed a very deep friendship over that time.
Yeah.
And then when he came back, I went through a pretty heavy health battle when he like coincidentally came back to Perth, and that's when we started spending quite a lot of time together, and then comedy for me and him was like almost a way of like my therapy. And from that end, he started mentoring me and setting a goal for me in order to like open for him for Fringe and what I needed to do. And for me, that was a very healing, but also a very, very significant step into developing not only my craft, but also him just becoming my mentor. And it wasn't one of those things where it was like a formal thing.
Yeah.
He just became it, you know? And that's when I started confiding in him much more from a comedy sense, and watching him and, you know, going to his shows and, you know, looking at the way that, you know, the rule of three, like seeing the way punchlines were. And I was just shaking my head thinking, damn, when I first started, like, where was my punchlines? Like, you know, what was I even doing on stage? So Joe sort of taught me and is continuing to still teach me a lot about, like, just the art of, I guess, telling a story. So yeah. he somehow just became my mentor, and I respect him and admire him a lot.
When you say rule of threes, what do you mean?
It's kind of just like a rhythm. So yep. It's kind of like da-da-da, laugh, da-da-da, laugh, da-da-da. And that's your final big laugh for yep. like a joke, you know. So it's all those little practical joke, like things about storytelling that Joe started teaching me. And it wasn't necessarily a formal way of teaching. It was more just through absorption.
Yeah.
Because I'm a very observant human being. So I've never really had anyone like, yeah, and you know, to be able to bounce ideas from and that sort of thing. And yeah, and strangely, I had a friend that came and watched a couple of my shows, and he seemed to be really inspired by what we were doing in Fringe. And then he started writing his own sets and started coming to me for advice. And, you know, he weirdly now considers me like a little bit of an inspiration to him, only being a year out. I find it really strange, but also very, you know, complimentary and endearing. And now I'm helping him yeah. sort of workshop. And I remember Joe actually saying to me, he actually said this, he goes, whenever you can find, or wherever you can find someone that you can help
yep.
and that you can give back to and that you can kind of like build up, then do that. And that's like the only thing I'm going to ask of you, you know, and obviously invest in good people.
Yeah.
You know.
That's great advice.
It's true, you know, yeah. because unfortunately, like the truth is the more and more deeper I go into the game, the more and more I realize that they're actually, I think when I first started, I had this assumption that everybody thought like me and everybody wants to help everyone. And I was just so excited
yeah.
to be around anybody that loved doing the same thing that I was doing. But then, you know, as I sort of started going to more and more gigs, I started realizing that's actually a very lonely game. Mm. And, you know, not everybody wants to see you excel, which yeah. is fine, because everybody's on their own journeys and everybody has their own things that they're dealing with in life. You know, no one's going to roll out the red carpet, and nor should you expect that. But I realize more and more how rare good people that are like your real supports and your real day ones are.
Yeah.
So, you know, to have found that in Joe and to have found that so early on, I didn't realize how lucky I was until...
You probably attracted him, but as well, Samia. Like,
I mean,
you know,
you just
really
had to take a look
that.
At me, you know. So, I mean, he's only human.
No,
I'm just kidding.
No, but you know, when yeah. you like attracts like, and
yeah.
you know, and he's a very good person, but so are you. So,
oh,
and one
you.
Of the best ways, I think, to grow within ourselves is to become a teacher and mentor as well. So that will just upskill you as
absolutely.
Much as it will upskill, you know, your friend as well. So
yes. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, it's yeah. really – you mentioned you experienced a health issue last year.
Yeah.
Are you happy to share about that
yeah,
journey?
Yeah, absolutely. So while everyone was dealing with COVID and, like, the pandemic being the worst thing that ever happened to them, I dealt with simultaneously literally dying. So that was a very, very heavy, heavy thing for me. Last year, I think it was August or early September, I experienced my very first anaphylactic reaction.
Mm.
But I went into anaphylactic shock. So being in like my mid-30s and never having an allergy at all in my life, which is, again, this is becoming very much a medical.
I know, that's okay.
Very informational. I just ordered some takeaway food at my friend's house, and it was something that I'd never eaten before. And there was obviously some kind of allergen reaction that I had. And within 0 to 5 minutes, I literally had passed out and I had no heartbeat, none. Like it was.
I actually get goosebumps when you tell me.
And, it was,
and I know the story, but it still gives me goosebumps to think.
Yeah, yeah. It was that quick. Horrible. It was just one of the most. I think for me, the hardest thing was just realizing, like I was consciously losing feeling of my legs and my arms, and my tongue was swelling up, and everything was just kind of happening. And it was actually only in 5 minutes, but it felt like 5 hours. And it's so weird, like the thoughts that were kind of just going through my head at the time, because it was almost like at first there was a lot of fear, but then it was almost like an acceptance that this is the way that you were going to go. And I tell you what, Yvonne, it was just the most craziest thing. Like, I don't know if this isn't divine intervention, I don't know what is. Because I was with my friend, thankfully. So if that had happened to me by myself, I would not have been able to call the ambulance, because I literally had no feeling. So my friend obviously called the ambulance. She was frantic. And the ambulance had said that they're going to be 15 minutes. And within 5 minutes, I was actually dead. Like, I had nothing. I had no heartbeat. The ambulance came in 3 minutes.
Oh my gosh. Thank goodness.
I tell you what, it wasn't the ambulance that was dispatched. It was an ambulance that was driving home from another job, and he had literally passed our house that we were at.
Yeah.
And he just thought, oh, there's a job that came through his radio signal. He was actually meant to clock off and go home, but he for some reason thought, I'm just going to go in. And so he came in 3 minutes, and I tell you what, up until today, I still think he was my guardian angel.
I have chills running through me. Yeah. Hey.
So he came in 3 minutes, picked me up, you know.
Have you ever got to meet him again?
He not only came to my hospital.
Yeah.
I've written him a very personal letter.
That is so special. And
yeah, it's still really hard for me, but he was very special. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, for him to listen to that calling.
Yeah.
And when I say calling, I don't mean just the radio announcement.
No.
He listened to his inner self and he saved you.
Yeah.
So
literally saved my life. So he's just amazing. And I think he was the reason, like, you know, even because I had flatlined and he had obviously used a defibrillator and, you know, like the adrenaline and pumped all that stuff in. But even in the ambulance, I lost consciousness and, you know, actually had – I know this sounds strange, but it happened and it's my truth, but I had transitioned over.
Yeah.
And it was actually his voice that I could hear him, like, literally screaming from afar, telling me to come back, that had brought me back. And it was – you know, when I think about that experience and go through it, I will always just remember him as, like, my angel. And I just think – you know, he's an example of, we can get very bogged down with a lot of pain and a lot of sadness and a lot of, I guess, just crap that happens in our life with a lot of crap people that are around. But, you know, among us, there are a lot of good people and a lot of angels that are roaming.
Yeah.
And we just have to really hold on to that, you know. So, so I was in the hospital for 3 weeks. I had moved back home for 3 months. I was off work for several weeks. I had, like, experienced memory loss, I was in rehabilitation. I still suffer PTSD, so I got quite a bit of nightmares. I have like a recurring nightmare where like at nighttime there's like this black hand and it comes and it just like grabs me from underneath and it goes over my face and suffocates me. And I think it's just that it's still something that happens quite regularly, which is what I was dealing with. It's really incredible when I look back on my journey and just think that that happened in August, September, and then, you know, in January I was performing every night in Fringe, you know. And it's just amazing, as comedians, all the different masks that you wear.
Yeah.
You know, because you just, that's irrelevant, you know, who you are, what you do, where you're from, the sadness that you experience. When you're on stage, you're just a different person and all you're doing is giving energy out.
Yeah.
And I think for me personally, it was a massive lifesaver for me. I think I would be in a really bad place if I didn't have comedy. So, yeah.
And well done for Joe giving you that goal as well and keeping, you know, that path for you to step up and go, okay, I can do this, I can. And then you also did Janelle Koenig's show as well, didn't you, during Fringe? You were busy during Fringe.
I was.
you did some amazing shows, by the way.
Oh, Janelle was another one. She was just incredible. And that was, you know, again, all thanks to you. Like I, you know, we talk about first, we talk about people in the industry. We talk about, you know, the people that you instantly meet that you just have incredible, beautiful, flowing, lovely energy with, and I definitely think you were 100% one of them.
Oh,
and NY Events was just such an integral part of like my growth in my first year of comedy because you guys, you know, I don't know, believed in me for some strange reason.
You're amazing.
So. You know, like for some strange reason, I was like, okay, like that's cool. And then you guys, you know, booked me for a couple of my first ever, you know, ever like professional shows, and it was just amazing. And I think when you really love and admire and respect people that are at the top, that are giving you these opportunities, when it comes out of a place of love, it doesn't feel like work. It just feels like, you know, it's not that I want to impress them, it's just that I want to justify why I've been given that position. And I also feel that for you, I feel that for Janelle, I feel that for Joe.
Yeah.
And Janelle met me at one of the events that you booked me in where she was obviously headlining because, Jesus Christ, she's amazing and my ultimate goal.
She's amazing.
She's amazing. She is hilarious. Like, she is a firecracker. I don't think I've ever seen anyone as just – she just – yeah, amazing, amazing. Yeah. And I got to just meet her. Then just have a bit of a chat with her back in October at one of your gigs. And then she booked me for one of her biggest shows at the Astor Theatre in early January. So that was a stellar lineup and that was a sold out crowd. And that was my first, like, you know, really massive show. And I was busy.
You were very busy, I've got to say.
Yeah. So,
yeah. You know, you've had an incredible journey, and for someone that's done it for, you know, you said a year.
Yes.
And then we've had COVID in that time, and you've had an illness in that time.
Yes.
You're smashing it, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much.
Sammy, can I ask you about being a female comic in our Perth scene predominantly? Cause I don't know what happens in the rest of the world. What is it like?
Being a female comic?
Yeah.
Well, I guess, yeah. Look, I mean, the elephant in the room is definitely that, you know, we are already a minority. It is a very heavily male-dominated industry, you know, and whether or not that's opportunity or whether or not that's just not enough women kind of really stepping up or grinding for, like, places in lineups, I'm not sure. But, you know, I've always been fairly, I guess, positive about you know, you're just being a female in the industry. But I think it's only recently I started feeling not necessarily singled out, but feeling the weight of being the minority, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I explained that or articulated that very clear. My apologies. But recently I was just at a room where you know, I was the only female in a lineup. And there was a male comedian that just made me feel very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
With just a couple of comments that he made to me, particularly about what I was wearing in one of the shows that he came and watched me in.
Did you feel objectified in that instance?
I felt extremely objectified. And I think, I'm a very intuitive person and I really rely very heavily on energy. And I think the way that I had felt, like, honestly, Yvonne, at that minute, I actually felt chills through my body, and it was not funny, and it wasn't a joke. And the worst part about it, so he had made a couple of comments about what I was wearing on stage in one of the shows that he had come and watched me in during Fringe.
Yeah.
And what I had thought was initially a compliment that he had come and watched and I wanted to say thank you had turned into a very awkward what I was wearing on stage, and how he really didn't care what I was saying on stage. It was more about what I was wearing that he was enjoying. So that was a lot among the lines of what was said. And I had felt immediately like just – I actually felt – I felt harassed.
Yeah.
You know, that's probably the best way to put it. And the worst part about it was that the comment was made among at least five other male comedians that were also on the lineup at the time. And my face don't lie.
No.
I wasn't, you know, encouraging it or laughing or smiling or, you know, giving any kind of impression that this was okay.
Yeah.
And going along with it, I was, you know, visibly quite upset and visibly had kind of retracted. And not one – I think the worst part about it was that not one – fellow comedian stepped up or even addressed the behavior, like, and just say, oh, hang on a minute, mate, like, that's not right, or come on, like, that's a bit
so
of a
so they
stupid,
were bystanders.
Just bystanders, you know, and not that they were participating actively, but the fact that that wasn't even, that was okay when it very clearly wasn't. And, you know, I'm not someone that's going in to actively start up anything or use the whole, you know, I'm the only female card in like anything. Like, that's never been me.
No.
But I think, and you know, it's really interesting, Yvonne, because I've heard about it and I've read about it among other women in the industry. And like, even in myself, I was ashamed to say, if I'm going to be brutally honest with you, I've always been like, are they just, you know, are they just trying to make something because we're, you know, we're always the only woman in a lineup and we're trying to make it about something else? But we're not.
Yeah.
We're not. And it wasn't until I experienced it myself where I visibly felt uncomfortable, but also I'm going to go as far as to say scared.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's not okay to feel scared.
No.
And I want to shout out to any of the men that witness this.
Yeah.
Please stand up and stand alongside that female in the room and just be there as that support and say to the other person, it's not okay.
No.
If we're in a workplace and if you behaved in that manner, then that is, you know, that's fireable.
Yeah. So. Absolutely. Despicable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Despicable. And, yeah, and it just went as far as, like, you know, me feeling really uncomfortable that I'm walking back to my car at night, you know, in the same space that there is someone that was viewing me all along in this really, really strange, sexually pervasive way.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether or not that was a joke or not, which it wasn't,
no.
But even if it was, it's not funny.
Yeah.
So I think
– I think a joke at your expense – it's never funny.
No.
You know?
No.
That, yeah, I don't know. That's – if someone feels that – you know, if you're making someone feel uncomfortable, that's – there's no humor in that.
No.
There's nothing beautiful in that. There's no – yeah, it's a low intellectual stance, isn't it?
Definitely not. But I don't know whether or not they – and when I say they, I mean, you know, the very few that do go ahead with this kind of humor think that it's okay. I think they use the whole card of everybody gets offended about everything with comedy, but it's not because you're actually targeting someone. So I have been quite weary of that room ever since. And I've made a stand, you know, not to kind of go back unless I receive like a formal apology.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not really comfortable with that. So that was my first experience. Luckily for me, a year in where I did feel quite uncomfortable. Yeah.
And I think putting up some safe boundaries as well. So maybe four lineups, maybe looking at maybe having more than just one female in that room so that it is a bit safer.
Wow. So, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that would be more from – sorry to interrupt. That would be more from a – that would be a conversation for events promoters and bookers to really have and look at doing. Which is
there is safety in numbers.
Absolutely. There is safety in numbers. But, you know, just to give a shout out to another sort of room that I love performing in and I feel extremely supported and safe in would be the Laugh Resort.
Oh, they're great, yeah.
Oh, incredible. I mean, yeah. I was lucky enough to do a couple of sort of gigs there. Not only is it just run so well, but I was just so pleased to also see that there's quite a bit of women that make up even like the board.
Yeah, I'm on the board. Did you know that?
I did know that. I did know that. So
I love Laugh Resort. Yeah. They're amazing.
Just really well run. So yeah. I do want to make that clear that I don't think it's all rooms or anything like that. I think as long as we're conscious and woke and aware and we're a little bit more conscientious, and I think bookers need to also be not brave enough, but yeah, kind of have the balls enough to have conversations with these particular people if they are,
yeah,
if they are, you know, uncomfortable.
Yeah, have those sticky conversations. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
have a standard.
Have a standard.
It's absolutely. It's not hard to have a standard, is it?
No.
What is something that motivates you to do comedy? I know that I've asked what brought you to comedy, but yeah, why do you want to keep going in it? And
I think for me, it's just, like I said, it's extremely therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just the one place in the world, like no matter what I'm going through, which is a lot of the stuff that I spoke to you about today.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, no one would have even had an inkling of what I was processing during Fringe, because every night it was just go, 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 you know, and bang, bang, bang. It really is an escapism for me. It's an escapism for me. And I remember my very first gig at the Comedy Lounge. This story would have been so much more heartfelt if I remember who the comedian was that said these words to me. I don't remember who, but it was someone amazing. But before I went on stage, I remember saying to him, it was like the first time I'm ever doing comedy. I don't know what I'm doing. And oh my gosh, I'm so scared. And I remember him going, as soon as you get the first laugh, I promise you it's better than any drug. It's better than anything you have ever experienced. Like you actually just wait for it. Wait for the first ripple of laughter and it'll just go through your veins. Not that I do drugs, but you know, like, you know, that is what he said.
Yeah.
And I kid you not, Yvonne, I still up until today, every time I hear like that first like massive ripple,
yeah,
of laughter, it is like this like serotonin or adrenaline that just like invigorates me as a person. So it's not, it's just like my forever love at this point, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's just something that just takes me away from everyday life, really.
Yeah.
You know, and it builds me, and it, you know, I have to grow from this all the time, and you know, it builds my character, because like I said to you, comedy is also such a lonely journey. You know what people don't see is like they see these great like awesome gigs and nice pictures or whatnot, but what they don't see is like the 3 or 4 times a week where you're driving to open mic rooms by yourself after work when no one's there cheering you on or supporting you, where you're bombing with a new joke that's not quite working, or where there's, you know, rooms where it's, you know, where you fall completely flat. And the commitment and like the drive and also the time that we all put, or you know, you put towards like the art, you know, this is a very growing craft for me, because it builds me as a person. And like every time I've fallen flat on my face, I've had to build a real love with myself where I pick myself up. And I don't think there's anything in the world that gives you that, you know, where like you have to be like, okay, I love myself enough, or I believe in myself enough to know that that one joke or that one gig or that one experience isn't defining me. And the amount of mental energy it takes for me to get up and go, okay, I'm just going to keep going. That's what comedy does for me. And so it builds this resilience, which nothing has done for me before. Like I've done things before, you know, I've dabbled in singing, I've dabbled in playing guitar. I've dabbled in Spanish dancing. Just all these random kind of things where I've needed some kind of creative outlet, but nothing has been as rewarding or long lasting as comedy has for me. So, yeah.
What do you think your creative process is?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
My creative process is, it's really interesting. I doodle a lot.
Yeah.
Like I have a lot of really funny things that happen and like conversations sometimes through my friends that are hilarious. They are such a great source of comedy for me because like attracts like, and I have a lot of crazy people in my life and just funny things. My family, oh my goodness, incredible. My parents are just probably my like one of the funniest people I've ever come across. And so I'm very observant with conversations or incidents or events or things that have either happened to myself or other people that people I look in a room that find universally people find quite funny.
Yeah.
And then I write that as a premise. So then I'll go and doodle and I'll be like, okay, something about, you know, pole dancing where my dad thinks I'm going pole dancing. Where my dad thinks I'm going classical Indian dancing, but really I'm going pole dancing, you know, because I lied to him and I said that. But, you know, like just funny things where he just believes anything, or, you know, the way my parents interact with each other, or like, you know, just like, yeah, it's a lot of conversations, a lot of observations, and then always kind of, you know, my mum went to a psychic or a clairvoyant, and, you know, this is a true story, and she went because she was so sad that I'm unmarried. You know, and it's kind of like any other person would be really offended by this, you know. Don't forget they don't acknowledge any of my other achievements. Like the fact that I'm not married. Like, Mom, you really went to a clairvoyant because I'm unmarried? Like, you know, but see, I find that funny.
Yeah, and so I
just
do
think,
I.
Yeah, you know, I just think I could easily make that into a joke and act it out. And, you know, like it's those daily observations that are a part of my everyday life that I'll –
I love that you choose, it's a choice, but you choose to not be offended by that.
Yes.
You choose to see the humor in it.
Yes.
And that's pretty special.
Yeah.
And it is funny. Like,
yeah.
I would laugh my head off if my mom said that to me.
It's just like, they're still so old school, you know? Like when I first moved into my, this is all true stories. Like when I first moved into my house, which I had built by myself, not
it's
with any
amazing,
help.
Amazing, right?
Massive achievement, you know, thinking my parents would be super proud.
Yeah.
Like my mum literally came into my house like she had just come like to a funeral. Oh. Like she was just so sad.
Yeah.
And then I find out that she had gone to my Indian neighbor's house, who's a single male, next door. So he literally lives next door to me.
Yeah.
She had gone and told him, I'm a teacher. I have a master's. I live on my own, literally giving him my entire bio data, like a dating profile, and just said, I'm single and she's by herself. So please, if you could just look after her, like some random guy I've never met that lives next door to me. And so every time, like up until today, every time I walk past that guy, he's just kind of looking at me like, hey, what's up? Well, you know, I know you want a bit of this. Like, cause you know, my mom has like essentially gone and sold me to some guy. Like that's the type of stuff that happens to me, and it's like, well, look, if you're not going to laugh about it, you're definitely going to cry
I'm laughing inside because my ideal perfect relationship is the guy that lives next door. I don't want to live with anyone ever again.
Oh gosh, I tell you what, that would be perfect. Yeah.
Oh, that's
might
so
have to
funny.
Give him a call. No, could be something actually. I didn't even think about that.
What is your biggest Sorry, I'm going to recollect my thoughts here.
It's okay.
The best moment as a performer for you?
Oh, the best moment as a performer for me? You know what? I'm going to have to say it was Fringe.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2021, and it would have been like the second close, like just the second last night, closing night where – not second last night before we closed, sorry, and that was a massive crowd. We were at the girls' main hall, at the girls' school. It was like sold out. The lights and glamour were just beautiful. I felt great. A lot of my family and friends came to support. So it was just a really wonderful moment. And I said a few words about Joe. And it was just one of those sets where everything was hitting and the audience seemed to be in like a lot of like, had a lot of love and appreciation. And I think it was I just felt like, yeah, I just felt so happy. I think that was one of my best, yeah, moments where I was just like, this is exactly what I want to do. Because there just seemed to be a lot of, there just seemed to be a lot of love in that room.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's important. And have you had one time during comedy where you've had a big learning curve?
Yeah, in the beginning.
Yeah.
In the beginning, I'd probably say it was when I performed at the Ultimate Funniest Comedian. The UFC. And I just think that was a massive learning curve for me because I definitely, as a performer, was not ready to be, you know, in sort of a lineup with all these industry heavyweights like Rory and Wolfie and, you know, Jason Wood, like just, you know, incredible people that were so far along, experienced and well-versed in the game.
Mm.
And I was in the semi-finals and I had a really, really bad set. Like I felt myself, I had a really, really bad set and it just wasn't refined and it was angry and it was just not authentic to who I was.
Yeah.
And I remember just not getting the response that I had hoped for. And to be honest, Yvonne, that was for me, like I actually went through about a month where I was convinced I'm never going to do comedy again because I felt quite humiliated.
Oh, yeah. I'm so glad you did, but that's it is just a learning curve, isn't it?
It was, and that for me was just when I just thought, I don't know if I'm ever going to do comedy again because that for me was a massive flop.
Mm.
But, you know, looking back on it, I think that was also what propelled me forward.
Yeah.
To then really put in the work, you know, and really kind of refine and really find like the punchlines and really kind of be prepared because, you know, and I don't know how I feel about competitions, to be honest, because, you know, a lot of the times I think we focus so much about how other people are doing.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? And you're not really focusing on yourself and then that can be, you can get very lost in that.
Yeah.
And just even like the idea of like competing against one another.
Yeah.
You know, the UFC was, while it was an incredible experience for me, and you know, what an amazing event and what an amazingly well run by Jasky.
Incredible. Yeah.
Incredible, right? Yeah. But I, for myself, that was a massive learning curve for me to never sort of step into like an arena where I have that much exposure where I'm not ready and I'm not justified being in a position of like the semifinal. I don't know how I got into the semifinal, but I did and I didn't deliver. So, yeah, that was a learning curve for me.
I think you hit the nail on the head before when you said the word resilience.
Yes.
Yeah. And it does. It teaches resilience, doesn't it? And
yes.
Yeah. And thank goodness you stepped back up and
kept going.
Yeah. You did. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. And look how much you've grown in a year, despite COVID, despite your health issue.
Yes.
You've overcome so much to be where you are today.
So. Oh, thank you so much. I think the next goal for me really is to develop some universally relatable content. I've been very honest with myself and lately I haven't really been writing as much as I should be.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a really, really hard thing to do with comedy or any art really when you've got a lot of things going on personally.
Mm.
And I think the art of it is to truly be able to compartmentalize and actually commit and dedicate the time. And so if this is something that I really want to do, which it is, then, you know, I've really just got to knuckle up, buttercup, and just go with it.
5 years' time, where do you see yourself with comedy?
5 years' time, I really hope that this is what I'm going to be doing as my bread and butter.
That'll be amazing.
Yeah. 5 years' time, I really hope, whether it's in an interstate level or an international level, you know, if comedy opens up doors for me where I would have to make drastic changes in my life, but it's a sustainable long-term way of living.
Yeah.
I would 100% do it because I'm afraid of stagnancy in life. Mm. I'm not afraid of change. I think most people are afraid of change.
Yeah.
But I can't think of anything worse than staying in the same place.
Oh my gosh, I hear you. I cannot handle the idea of Groundhog Day.
I feel like
I'm not comfortable in that.
I feel like most of us are, and I feel like we, as the masses, are brainwashed into fearing change.
Mm.
But change is where the growth happens, you know. Yeah. So
change is evolution, isn't it?
It's evolution.
Yeah,
100%.
It's so good for you. Like,
Yeah.
And you can fear change, but the more you step into it and towards something that you really want to do, and that self-belief is so important, isn't it?
So important, yeah. And I think I've lived in a lot of different places.
Yeah.
You know, I lived in London for 3 years, Melbourne for 6 years. I've always kind of been on my own and globetrotted a lot, traveled a lot. And I think when you have exposure to like the masses of different people and different ways of living, you realize that your experience is really just relative to your environment.
Mm-hmm. That's really well said, actually. Yeah. So true. You know,
in like bigger cities, it's so much more culturally diverse, so much more eclectic. Like there's so many different types of people from all walks of life, you know, and it's just something that really excites me. So I would easily move where I had to go.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. How can people find you on social medias?
If you just look up Miss Samia, M-I-S-S and S-A-M-I-A, I've got a Facebook page, and miss.samia1 on Instagram. That's where you'll find me.
Do you have TikTok as well?
I do have TikTok. Miss Samia on TikTok. I don't do a lot of TikTok though. I don't know. I do
I'm just
have
seeing
TikTok.
Some people get some real acceleration with
I do have to. It might be something I will be looking into doing more of, but definitely Facebook. That's my page where I usually post all the links of places that I perform in. Awesome. And Instagram as well.
Yeah, thank you. And do you have a joke that you could perhaps share with us?
Well, do you want a joke or do you want a real story that ended up being into a ridiculous...
I love your story.
Of course, this happened to me. And again, this is a true story, Yvonne. So I live up in the, area where... Like I live up in sort of the Guildford area where the fires were quite prevalent in the beginning of the year with all the bushfires. So we were in the danger zone and I actually had to evacuate for a night. And, you know, obviously first-handedly saw how hard the firefighters worked, and they're just incredible. And I just have so much mad love and respect for the work that they do.
Yeah.
So I went on to my community, so my neighbourhood community page, and that's got, I think, about like 6,000 followers. So there's a lot of people that's on it. It's a very, like, you know, active page. And I wanted to thank the firefighters. So I wrote, "Firemen are the reason heroes exist. But trust my luck, heroes had auto-corrected to herpes." And the worst part about it was I hadn't had realized until like 7 hours later when I checked my Facebook again and I had like 300 notifications.
300?
It was immense. Like I wish I had screenshotted it and it was just the amount of people giving me crap about, you know, oh, so you're fighting a different kind of fire in your bush. Like all sorts of comments from all my neighbors. And I was just like... like I said, like, meh, whatever, you know, like, I could have just crumbled and been, I was like, this is the type of stuff that happens to me. I tell you what.
Well, people like sideways glancing you like, yeah, I know.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So now they know what pole the firemen slide down on the weekends. Like it's obviously me, you know, so that's the thing. You just turn it into humor.
You're just going to laugh, don't you?
You're going to laugh. I always do. So yeah.
I love it. Have you got any shows coming up?
Yes, I do actually. On the 8th of April, I'm at the Balmoral Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
That's Pinder's emceeing. John Pinder is one of my favourites. Oh, he's incredible.
Awesome. Yeah,
with
love
Matt
him.
Storer, Kate Willoughby, and Nadia Collins, who I just adore Nadia Collins as well. And then the 17th of April, I'm at the Crushes Comedy Gala, which I'm so excited about. That's at the Rekabite. So they're probably my two big gigs that are just coming up.
Rekabite is such a great venue.
I know. I'm so excited for that night as well. So.
There's a feel in that place. Like, yeah.
I'm really stoked that they, considered me to get on that stage as well. So I'm really excited and pumped.
Oh, it's awesome. And we at NY Events have a number of comedies coming up. If you check out our Facebook page, Instagram, or our website, which is nyevents.com.au/comedy. Thank you so much, Miss Samia, for coming in today. Thank you for everyone to listen. And, I can't thank you enough, actually.
It's been a wonderful. Pleasure. It's been a pleasure, treasure. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right, have a great day, everyone.